This is Stan Z Perspectives.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Stan Z Perspectives. I am Yahya, one of your hosts for today. My main scientific interests are physics, astronomy, and climate science.
And I'm Kuzi, a production executive at the Young Scientist Journal.
In today's episode, we'll be talking to Vanessa, a final year mathematics student at Imperial College of London. She specializes in fluid dynamics and is extremely devoted to science communication and helping everyone understand the workings of this universe. She has engaged in multiple talks at the venues such as House of Commons to talk about the ways to diversify STEM, as well as explaining topics in mathematics and physics to both academic and general audience. She is the recipient of the Imperial College President Student Award for Societal Engagement, Imperial College Outstanding Award, the Rare Rising Star Award, and so many more accolades. This episode will focus on Vanessa's interest in physics and mathematics, what led to those interests, and what she hopes to further pursue in her academic interests. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Well, that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you. Well, hello. Yeah, I'm really excited to be talking with you today.
Thank you so much. So, Kuzi, can you start with the first question?
Sure. So our initial question is, what got you interested in pursuing mathematics and specifically fluid dynamics?
Okay, so those two things, they're quite separate stories, but I do love this question because I have quite a cute story. So I grew up really, really hating maths. I thought it was really boring. I was more of an arty kid. But then, you know, I got to year nine, so I think 13. And my teacher kind of noticed that it wasn't that I didn't know how to do it. It was that I didn't have any interest to try. And so he sort of put quite a lot of effort into sort of getting me to try a bit harder. And then that was the beginning of the realization that, oh, wait, this is kind of cool. But what really did it for me was when around that time, I went to a fair and they had one of those games where they had like a jar of marbles and you had to guess the number of marbles in the jar and then you win the jar. And so I was quite enamored by this game. So I thought, let's give it a go. And the people doing it let me get maybe a bit too close with a piece of paper, you know, blank piece of paper, you know, no pencils or pens or anything, just a piece of paper. And because I know how long a piece of paper is and roughly what, like the heights, like how much the paper, the length of the jar took, that kind of thing, and some approximations. And yeah, so with some approximations and some other clever maths, I'm now the owner of 432 marbles, which was exactly the number of marbles in the jar. And even though, you know, it's just a game, right? Just jar of marbles in a jar, but the principle stuck with me. It's like I could find out something about the world that might be really difficult or take ages to find out if I didn't have this wonderful language that is maths. And so I actually pretty much do the same thing now. I just do it for systems a bit more complicated than a jar of marbles, which leads me into what I am now doing. So fluid dynamics. This was actually born out of something of an existential crisis that I had at the end of my second year at university. I decided I hated maths. I didn't want to do it anymore. It's too prescriptive, just wasn't my thing. So I decided I wanted to be an engineer because then I get to do stuff. And so in the middle of trying to work out what kind of engineering I'd want to do, I came across planes and the way that their wings work and things like that. And I thought this was fantastic. this is like so, so clever. And just the people thought of this, and I just think that's absolutely remarkable. And so then I sort of dug into this rabbit hole and just getting more and more excited about this thing that was fluid dynamics. Lots of number file videos, many sort of experiments, looking at those on YouTube. And then eventually I realized, oh no, I don't think I'm an engineer because I'm really interested in the why of this. I'm just an applied mathematician and I am now here.
That's great. I also used to not like maths a lot, but with time I started liking it when I really understood maths and realized how beautiful it is and how it couldn't really show what nature really is, and that's really got me interested in maths. But yeah, you talk about fluid dynamics. So can you explain it to our listeners in a more layman language what fluid dynamics really is and what you really do with it?
Okay. Oh, okay. So fluid dynamics has a bit of a reputation for being terrifying, and it's, while it's very technical, you know, the equations that we use are pretty brutal. The concepts within them are not so much. And so I guess maybe if we sort of, okay, let's liken it to a solid. I guess, you know, you've seen a solid in school, right? You know, you've got these atoms that are really packed close together. And, you know, if you give it a squish, then it gives you a squish back so that it doesn't have to squish, that kind of thing. It has these properties that are associated with the ways that the molecules are arranged. And you can do that for a fluid. You may have then heard in a liquid or in a gas, the particles are much further apart. And so then if you give it a push, then things slide past other things and you get deformation. But it turns out that when you want to understand the way that a fluid behaves on maybe a slightly bigger scale, following every single molecule in the fluid around is a bit of a long process. It's computationally expensive, so it takes computers loads of resources to do it. And it's just not a very good way of doing fluids when you're looking at the ocean, for example. You don't particularly want to be following individual particles in the Pacific. So instead, what we do is we sort of we think of a fluid, think of it in like a box or something, and then we subdivide it into lots of little cubes. Or if it's flat, if it's 2D, then in lots of little squares, or it doesn't have to be squares, just lots of little shapes. And then we follow each of those things around. And those little sort of boxes, I guess, are called fluid particles. And that's where we get to ask questions about what's the density at this point, what's the temperature at this point, and using sort of that notion of things, where we've got this continuum. So we've got, you know, instead of looking at each individual particles that you can count, we've just got sort of there's not individual particles. Basically, we just split up a continuous thing, like the same way that you would split the number line into intervals. So you could say all the numbers between 0 and 1, all the numbers between 1 and 2, and so on. And so that's kind of what we do, I guess. And then from that, we can build upwards and ask questions about, you know, how are the forces involved here? And we have a sort of fluid dynamical version of Navier-Stokes, which, fluid dynamical version of Newton's second law, so F equals ma, and I spoiled the game there. It's called Navier-Stokes. And that asks us, okay, so how are the forces in a fluid related to the acceleration that happens as a result? And from Navier-Stokes, you know, the world's kind of your oyster. Very, very difficult equations. There's a Millennium Prize regarding the Navier-Stokes. And so this is more what I do now. So looking at maybe slightly easier versions of Navier-Stokes, so things that have been approximated, and then applying it to things like the ocean and asking, okay, now I know this type of phenomena happened in the ocean, let's look at this fluid dynamically, or using these equations that are all built on this idea that instead of looking at fluid like molecules, lots of H2O, we're looking at this sort of continuum of fluid. And yeah, that's fluid dynamics.
Yeah, thank you. That's brilliant. And well, getting to where you are right now, you probably took some A-levels in high school. So yeah. Could you tell us more about the A-levels that you took, and do you have any advice for fellow sixth form students?
Okay, so I did sort of very common combination at Imperial. I did maths, further maths, physics, and chemistry. And so I think the first thing I'd like to address there is the fact that I did 4. This is not a necessary thing to do. And this is the first recommendation I guess I'd make, is only do 4 if The way I describe it to people when I was in sixth form was, you would have to drag me kicking and screaming out of any of those classes. And that's really, in my head, the only valid reason to do four is if you all love them all so much that the idea of dropping any of them, like, makes you react very viscerally. And so I didn't drop any, and I'm very glad I didn't. So maths was my thing. Maths is still my thing. I was very good at it. And so it, for lack of better phrasing, calmed me down. I know there's a lot of people that don't feel like that way. You know, maths to a lot of people is very nauseating. But for me, I really enjoyed it. So it was, it was my pleasure to work on it consistently. That said, my school didn't offer an A-level in further maths, which is a problem if you want to do a maths degree. So I did the only thing I could do in that situation, which was to get the textbooks, sit down with them, and, make very good friends. And so, yeah, I self-taught. There were some modules that my teachers were able to teach, but not all of them. And, as unpleasant as that was at the time, the skill to learn stuff on your own is very, very useful when you come to do your degree, because you don't have, teachers breathing down your neck in the same way that you do at school. So it's definitely a possible thing to do, to self-teach further maths, but I find more schools are offering it now, which, I'm very pleased to hear, because it's a bit of a, a gatekeep for people who want to do maths or, physics degrees. My other two, physics is a very difficult A-level. At least I found it was the one I had to work hardest in, for sure, because it was, applied math, I guess, but there are some concepts that I sort of had to bend my mind to understand. So I'm thinking electricity, for example. I could do it, but it's because, I knew how to do it rather than I fully understood the way that it worked. I remember the day that I found out that all of our conventions are wrong because they were designed with the assumption that electrons are positively charged. I thought it was hilarious. And then it was just too much effort to change it now. So we just pretend that electrons are in fact positively charged. But that's physics, right? So it's like, it was like sort of things like that that threw me. Chemistry was a bit of a forbidden love for me, because I knew I was going to be a sort of very mathy physics person. And it was a lot of hard work. There's a lot of things you need to know in chemistry, but I love the practicals. I remember my last class in year 13, my teacher said we had a practical, and I did it twice, and my teacher came up to me and she was like, you're gonna miss this, aren't you? And I absolutely did, because I don't get to do practical work anymore. Those were my A levels, and sort of tried to sprinkle in some advice there, but anything sort of outside advice I'd give would be consistency is much, much better than, big burst work in terms of doing well in the long run, and also preserving your mental health. And so I'd suggest, I did quite well in my A-levels. So how I did that was, mocks came around, I did the mocks, and then I lightly continued to revise. I wasn't doing hardcore Easter revision. I was doing sort of little bits here and there, reminding myself of the stuff I did in year 12 when I was in year 13. And because I did it every day, by the time we got to exam season, I wasn't panicking. I just did the exams. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Even my school does not offer for them. And I regret that I didn't self-study it. I took economics instead of all the maths, but I think for me chemistry would be the hardest one because of so many information you need to cram up and learn, and especially organic. But I started liking organic towards the end. But yeah, but I would like to go back to your earlier statement about fluid dynamics, and I wanted to ask you, how does the theoretical experimental side of fluid dynamics intersect?
So, pardon me, could you repeat?
How does the theoretical and experimental side of fluid dynamics intersect?
This is a really funny one for a lot of reasons. So I know this particularly well in the context of oceanography, and there's a little bit of a running joke that mathematical oceanographers, or fluid dynamicists who do oceans from a mathematical point of view, don't really talk to the people that get the observations, so the people who do the experiments, and it's a problem, because, you know, if the people who are collecting your data don't know what kind of data you need, then the data's not very useful to you. But also, sort of, I think, and it's something that I want to see more sort of talking between people who do the sort of experimental stuff and the theoretical stuff, because it is very much they're two distinct camps. They work together sometimes, but they're very distinct. In sort of more classical fluid dynamics, so I'm talking, you know, what happens if you put water in a pipe and make it go, like that those are sort of very classical problems. There's a sort of nice amount of agreement, especially a long time ago. So I'm thinking people like Reynolds, who was a sort of mathematician slash physicist. He did a lot of stuff. And he did his experiments, and he both did them sort of pretty theoretically, and then he would, you know, test them out. So the kind of thing you'd hope to see. But as both the experiments and the theory became more complicated, they almost needed space to breathe. And so then that's when they sort of became separate fields, that are quite distinct from each other. But I think it would be good to see, you know, a bit more sort of intersection. It's even in the way that it's taught undergraduate level. Like, I do not get to see actual fluids very often at all, with the exception of, I had one lecturer, he was very good at this, actually, in terms of, you know, he'd bring in a little demo for us to show us, you know, a vortex in between two bottles, or a Cartesian diver. You can Google it later. That was nice, because, you know, then you get to see these fluid dynamical principles in action. But there's so much more room for it than it's, like, so underutilized. So, yeah.
Great. And when do we see these fluid dynamics principles in action in real life?
I love this question. So my favorite example is in the sky, and I'm not talking airplanes, I'm talking clouds. So clouds are by far my favorite visual representation of fluid dynamics, because you can, you know, you've got two different fluids, I guess. You've got the air, and then you've got water vapor, which is, you know, condensed, so it's cloud, and you can see what happens as these two things move past each other when there's spinning motions involved. Depending on how high up the water is, you get different cloud formations versus if they're lower down, and then if you've got sort of really favorable conditions, you get these waves that they're called Kelvin-Helmholtz waves, or clouds, sorry, and they look like ocean waves. So sort of, you see, just looking in the sky, and you see these things that look like ocean crests. They're really, really beautiful. And that is just, you know, what happens if you have a layer of cloud and a layer of air, and then they on top, and then they, you know, move past each other, but, you know, at different speeds. They could be going the same way, but different, like, with a relative speed. They could be going different ways. And if you introduce a little bit of a wiggle at the interface, you ask what happens, and usually that wiggle grows. And so you end up with this, like, sine wave looking thing between them. But because one's moving on top of the other, the tops get swept over. So you get these, like, if you can imagine them, kind of crests like that. Or like all of that really, really rich fluid dynamics, and it just happens in the sky. That's by far my favorite one. I'm quite awful at every opportunity I get. I give this example, including at parties, because I think they're fantastic. Another example, I'm trying to not go with the obvious ones, so things like planes, because, like, you know, you can, that I feel like that's quite, you know, that's quite clear how the fluid dynamics turns up there. Another one is what happens when you sneeze. Yeah. So obviously you sneeze and you've got a bunch of droplets that come out of your nose. And so, you know, people obviously knew that this was a thing that happened, but when, you know, when COVID rolled around, suddenly people are very concerned with what happens when they cough and when they sneeze. And so one of my lecturers last year is doing some really interesting research on this, sort of, you know, visualizing what happens when you sneeze and the fluid dynamical things that occur. And you get this sort of very chaotic motion called turbulence, sort of very close to the mouth of the person. And that kind of spreads out so that you've got you know, this droplets from your sneeze or from your cough going really, really far. And you can model the type of behavior that it shows by fluid dynamics. So that's another one. It really is everywhere, just because, you know, we exist in air and air is a fluid. We have loads of interactions with water. You know, you've even got fluid dynamics inside you because, you know, you've got blood, you've got water, you've got all sorts of things. And so, yeah, it's literally everywhere.
Yeah, that's really so cool. It's one of the main reasons why I'm so interested in fluid dynamics, because it's everywhere. And
yeah.
But we would like to shift towards more, so towards something more about you. And mm-hmm. So this question is, what does your day-to-day life looks like?
So I'm quite an organized person. I like to, you know, I have my routines. So this is, yeah, maybe an easier question than it might be for other people. So I tend to go into the maths department at Imperial. And so, you know, the boring stuff has to happen at the beginning of the day. You know, I deal with my emails, do all that stuff. And then it's a little bit variable, depending, it completely depends on the day. So I generally have lectures at some point. At most 4 hours of lecture, which is very, very brutal, and at usually at least one. And so those are very much, you know, I tend to read like what's coming up in the lecture before the lecture, just because it means that it's not a complete shock, because it's very information dense. And so it's a good idea to sort of have a little bit of a roadmap as to where the lecture is going. Then, you know, if you get a little bit lost, you've seen the map, so you just go to that point. Then I do maybe too much in terms of other things that aren't maths. I just care about a lot of stuff. Because I'm in my fourth year, I'm doing a research project. And so at some point, I try to find time in the day to get a bit more done with that. So it's a very coding heavy project, which means that I have to be quite awake when I'm doing it to not make mistakes. This code is in Fortran and in Python. So Fortran is a sort of very, very low level language. Very, very computationally efficient though. So if you want to do, you know, millions of calculations, Fortran is your, is the way to go. So Imperial sort of set up into different faculties. So I'm in the Faculty of Natural Sciences, and we have a annual science communication competition called the Science Challenge, and I'm also in charge of running that. So then when I'm not doing my maths, it's sort of when I'm not doing my daytime job, I'm sort of piecing together the bits of the Science Challenge, making sure that things happen. And then when it's neither of those things, because I am in fact a human that has other interests other than science, I'm big on crochet. So that's sort of how I wind down, that and reading. So there you go. That's a bit about me.
Well, that's really nice. And it seems like you'll be graduating from Imperial soon. Could you mm-hmm. talk about your plans after graduation?
Sure. Well, it's to study more, so it's a little bit boring. So I sort of fell so dramatically in love with what I'm doing for my fourth year research project, which is I'm looking at the clustering of stuff that floats on the ocean surface. And so examples of that are things like plastic. Humans are very good at getting plastic in the ocean. We are, however, awful at getting it out. And so my research at the moment is looking at, okay, well, say, you know, let's look at, you know, the set of all plastic, that's a bit hard in terms of a research question. So let's just look at the really tiny plastic or the microplastic and ask, is it clustering in places in the ocean? Because every time a ship goes on some expedition to try and get plastic out of the ocean, they find much, much less plastic than they should or than they predict. And so this is weird. And so the sort of hypothesis that we have is actually it's not uniformly distributed across the entire ocean. It's probably existing in sort of very tight clusters, which means these ship missions completely miss them because ships can only do so much. The ocean is very vast. So I'm looking at sort of creating models to see how things might cluster. And then I'm also particularly interested in, okay, what does that mean for things that also live on the ocean surface? So I'm thinking plankton. You know, plankton makes more than, I think about 70% of our oxygen comes from plankton. And so you don't really want to be messing with their populations. And so if you've got things like microplastic clustering, and you've got things like plankton, which, you know, algal blooms, those are clusters. What if they cluster together? And now I suddenly have a big problem. And so that's what I'm doing for my fourth year research project. And that is what I'm going to continue doing in my PhD, hopefully, provided, you know, we're in the middle of PhD application season. But that's the plan, that I continue the research that I'm doing, looking at that problem, but also, okay, we've got these massive data sets of observations within the ocean. So how can we use machine learning techniques to pull both observations and these physical models that I've made together? So that's what I'd like to do moving forward, PhD.
That's really so cool. And I wish I could also do some research in college, but yeah. So our second question, eighth question, would be that I saw that you are really interested in science communication, and you also take part in spreading science. So what advice would you have for someone who is going to pursue a career in scientific research?
Science communication is crucial for anyone any scientific person. I feel very strongly about this because, you know, I guess the way that I tend to describe general people's attitude to science is, science to me at least is, you know, it's the window with which we get to see how the world works. That's all. But for most people, at some point, because of, you know, whatever reason, you know, it could be questionable science teachers, it could be the way that science is presented in the media, that window gets very dirty. And so it's the job of the people who can see through the window, or the people who can, you know, of science communicators, to clean that window for people so that they can also see what this science is all about. And so the only people who are well equipped to do that are the people who understand the science, which is why I think it's like it's crucial. And it saddens me that it's not part of more science, engineering, technology, and maths degrees, because, you know, those are the people that understand the science. Those are the people that are going to become the scientific researchers, but we don't teach them to talk about the science. And so it means we've got this, you know, increasing divide of these people who are very scientifically literate. You know, they get their higher education degrees. And then we've got people who just, you know, they do science at school, they just don't get it, and then they don't ever get it. And I find that really sad. But it's also very dangerous, because, you know, if scientists don't communicate science, then non-scientists will communicate science. And then we end up in very sticky situations, like, you know, denying that climate change is a thing. or, you know, sort of a bit closer to home, things like sort of anti-vaxxers, people like that, is what happens when non-scientists communicate science, which means that really the people flooding the science communication market should be scientists. So that's the beginning of my advice, which would be, if you know science, if you know something scientific, and you don't have to be an expert, you know, you don't have to be a researcher, you can be at school and, you know, just have this really fascinating bit of science that's just your thing, go tell someone about it. but the key is to be able to explain it with no jargon. Like, that's how you know you really understand something, is if you don't need to use all those technical words. And so, yeah, I think it's something that everyone should do, because one, it helps you learn, and two, I mean, if you're a scientist, you probably find science interesting, so it's just mutually beneficial for both people involved in that interaction. So yeah, that's my advice.
Thank you. And somewhat related to science communication, some people struggle at school in physics or math subjects. Mm-hmm. So would you say that it's a matter of talent, ability, or practice? And what advice would you have for someone that's struggling to get into physics or maths?
That's a nice question. I mean, I think this is a very nuanced thing, and I'm trying to do it justice, which is why I'm sort of pausing here. But obviously, for every possible thing and skill that there exists, different people have different inclinations towards or away from it. So I'm hesitant to say talent and more sort of wanting to say sort of inclination, maybe. Because if you're really inclined towards something, then you're more likely to want to spend time doing it. And then, you know, you get good at it and then you want to keep doing it because it's fun and you get into this virtuous cycle. But if it's, you know, the opposite, you know, it's not really a thing. So you don't want to do it. So you can't do it. And so then, you know, you just keep going and that's a vicious cycle. So I think it's more that kind of thing. But of course, then through, it's a sort of mix of people's inclinations. There is some talent involved, you know, you can't deny that. But I think it's the reason I bring up these other things is it's a lot more complicated of a picture than just this person is talented. You've got this person is talented, this person works hard, this person is interested, this person is curious. And it's those things together that make a scientist rather than this person is talented. Because you would have heard the whole hard work beats talent if talent doesn't work hard. And so if you've got that's what my math teacher said that said they said that to me my last year of school. Yeah. And so it's stuck with me since though. So I think, you know, not everyone needs to be a scientist, but I think everyone should to some extent be scientifically literate. And so, you know, I think the people. So I would never say that I, you know, was going to do a whole let's get more people into science. I would more say I want every person who is scientifically inclined and enjoys science to get into science. And if, you know, if that's you, and you're scientifically inclined, then I guess taking every opportunity that comes at you in school and outside school, that's sort of how I develop the skill. Because it is a skill and it's something that needs to be worked hard on. But also, you know, you've got your stuff in your textbooks and that only takes you so far. So I'd say looking at where does your science fit in the grand scheme of all science? And then you get to draw this like really cool map of, you know, all of the things that we know to describe this crazy universe that we live in.
Certainly. Well, that'll be all from us today. Thank you so much for joining us.